It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Riverhounds are in the midst of their 20th season, and ownership has big plans to expand soccer in the Pittsburgh region. Tuffy Schallenberger is the owner of the Pittsburgh Riverhounds, and he joins us in studio. Welcome to the confluence.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
By the way, the Riverhounds beat the first place New York Red Bulls 2-1 in Montclair, New Jersey last night. I've got to ask, some of us are still riding high. We're still celebrating the World Cup victory by the U.S. women's team. How does a win like that on the global stage affect your club locally?
Well, it definitely draws more interest to the sport itself. It's a great win for the women's team, and it definitely spurs interest, especially in our youth academy. You know, it gets the kids out wanting to, you know, play. And we definitely see a spike every time one of these events happen. But it's soccer in general is just, it's just exploding, you know, in our area and all over the United States. But it's definitely give us a spike.
Does that spike last long, or do you have to take advantage of however you can take advantage of it, that increased interest for a certain time period? It's got a short shelf life.
It does, but I think just soccer in general, you know, years ago, I mean, soccer's just cool now, and you know, the fan bases are growing, and the kids are just, the amount of kids playing the sport now is just, it's unbelievable. I think there's around 45,000 kids in southwestern Pennsylvania, playing. But, soccer's on the rise, and I think, you know, with winning and what's going on here with our pro team, it's just drawing more and more interest. And soccer's been popular here in Pittsburgh. I mean, it goes back to the, you know, the days of the Spirit, and
Watch that indoor team. That was exciting.
Yeah. So there's a big fan base here in Pittsburgh. It's just just getting them converted over here to the Riverhounds, and it's really our attendance is showing. We're really going up this year. You know, we're our attendance is really growing, and winning helps.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned celebrating 20th season in the USL, attendance up significantly. Do you have a sense as to why that is, or is it this growth you were alluding to?
Well, I think it's multiple things. It's the growth on the youth side. It's winning. You got to win in Pittsburgh. I don't care what you're doing. You know, Pittsburgh's tough, and if you don't win, you're going to be looked over. And over the last couple years here, you know, bringing in Coach Lilly has changed the atmosphere. Has changed the whole organization.
I mean, he has a reputation.
Yeah, Bob is, he's won championships. He's in numerous clubs. He's Hall of Fame coach, and he's just brought a lot of respect to the sport, from the league. A couple years back, I mean, Pittsburgh would be looked at as we're going to come in here and get an easy 3 points, and now people know when they're coming to Highmark Stadium, they're in for a dogfight.
Well, for those who don't know, 3 points for a victory, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So maybe with that increase in attendance overall this year, it isn't just all national pride. For instance, the U.S. women's team, maybe some hometown pride as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have a player here from Pittsburgh area, Robbie Mertz. He's really come in and made an impact this year. So when you have homegrown talent like that, that's huge. And that's what we're trying to do with our academy. We're one of the only clubs that have, that our academy, our older boys practice with the pro team. You know, we'll pick some of the selected ones out of the 16, 17, 18-year-olds that actually get intertwined with the professionals during practice. And that's the ultimate goal, is to have the homegrown talent here to, at some point, you know, sign in one like Robbie. And it's working.
The academy's been around for about 15 years, I believe, somewhere.
Yeah, since 99. So.
Oh, even longer. Yeah. Okay. So what is it for young men and young women, or just?
Yeah. We have the grassroots program that they're starting them out at, you know, 3-4 years old, and they're coming out and kicking the ball around. And yeah, it's, I think we're up to about 45 teams now on our youth side. We're in high, one of the highest league on the girls' side. It's called the ECNL. Mm-hmm. They travel all over the United States. We actually had our 03 girls. They won the national championship out in San Diego here a month or so ago. So we're really developing some young players here.
How would you assess the overall quality of youth soccer play, whether at, say, maybe the high school level? Are our high schools creating some really good soccer players?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The whole area. There's a lot of talent coming out of this area. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're getting, you know, the talent is going to some of the highest colleges. We got girls at Notre Dame, Syracuse. I mean, there are a lot of D1 schools that we're kids are getting scholarships for.
Well, that brings me to the colleges themselves in Pittsburgh. How's the quality of their soccer? It seems like a lot of the stars, the high school stars, go elsewhere. Or am I wrong?
No, I think we're. I think you're going to see a change here. Pitt's early coming on here on both sides, girls and boys. West Virginia, they're ranked very high, and that's right in our backyard here. Mm-hmm. You know, I think on the girls' side here, they're usually in the top five last couple of years. So, now it's things are really looking good in our area here.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Tuffy Schallenberger, owner of the Pittsburgh Riverhounds. Of course, the Riverhounds have been playing at Highmark Stadium since 2013, I believe.
Yes.
It is. You just purchased the land under the stadium from the owners of Station Square. What does this mean for the Riverhounds organization?
Well, it was huge for us. Now we actually own everything. Before, you know, prior ownership had a land lease, and the stadium was owned by us. But, you know, the dirt was owned by Forest City. So, you know, what it does is it gives us longevity. Now, it gives us access to do expansion, and kind of we can set our own destination now.
Mm-hmm. Part of that expansion, I believe, will be helped out by a $1 million grant from the state through the Redevelopment Assistance Capital Program. How do you plan to use that money?
We're looking at a couple different projects. We're going to do some more luxury seating up out of the club area. We have a private club area where you can come in, upgrade your ticket, the buffet, all-you-can-eat buffet, and air conditioned, and you can come in and out and watch the game. But it's kind of crowded up there the way it's set up now. So I think we're going to look at putting some luxury seating outside of that club area where you can go in and out of the club like some of the other stadiums have. Mm-hmm. In the city here. So that'll really help us. And looking at a new press box, updated press boxes and stuff like that. So we're going to kick a couple different projects around here and see what fits best.
Does that state grant pay for the whole expansion plans?
No, the way they're set up, the state grant, they're a match. So whatever, you know, if it's $1 million, you have to match it with $1 million. So it'll be a couple $1 million project.
So attendance is up. You have a match. Does that mean you're sort of banking on it staying up?
Oh yeah, yeah. We're the highest percentage wise. Our attendance has grown the most in the USL of the 34 teams this year. I think we're up about 30% to 40% this year, and I think with the winning streak going on here, I think you're going to continue to in the stretch of the season here. If we can keep that going, it will. You'll see the attendance keep growing, which is great.
And the percentage, of course, is based on stadium size. Some stadiums are larger.
Exactly. Yes, but.
The Pirates, Steelers, Penguins, they've all received taxpayer money for ballparks, stadiums, arenas. Now the Riverhounds, albeit a much smaller state grant. As a taxpayer yourself, how do you feel about tax dollars going into sports facilities?
Well, I think you see a return on it. You know, we pay amusement taxes. We pay all the different taxes back. So you have to create a venue to get people in there to enjoy themselves. But they're getting it back, so... It's just all part of the system. I mean, we've gotten very little money. You know, 99% of that is all private money over there on our side. So,
mm-hmm. Did the state put any specific requirements or conditions on that grant?
No, it's just for improvements. So we're gonna get a couple different drawings made up of a couple different ideas we have, and then we'll present that back. And so there's no really anything etched in stone.
Our guest on The Confluence is the owner of the Pittsburgh Riverhounds, Tuffy Schallenberger. Are there enough facilities in our region for kids to play, to learn?
No, and that's one of the reasons for the Montour project. The area is definitely in need of more fields. You know, especially on the youth program side, you know, the kids are out at 10, 11 o'clock at night practicing because of field time, which is no good. That's no good having the kids out that late with school and so on and so forth. So the more fields, we can tighten that up a little bit, get these kids through. But, yeah, the two fields that are built out at Montour now, you know, they're book solid. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a 10-field project at some point, you know, once we get it built out, and it's needed. It's very much needed, and it's gonna help on the youth side a lot.
You announced that project, I believe it was in July, a partnership with Highmark and Allegheny Health Network to build a sports and health complex in the Coraopolis area. What else will it involve? So 10 fields, all outdoor, some indoor. What is it?
Yeah, there's two outdoor fields now. There will be 7 additional outdoor fields on the other side of Montour Creek. There will be an indoor facility built. It will be a full field indoor, and that's where the Allegheny Health Sports Medicine facility will be attached to that building.
Is that particular region, the western suburbs, Coraopolis, the Montour Project, as you call it, is that where the facilities are needed the most, or it was where you had space, or what?
No, they're definitely needed in that area. We're also building fields in Connellsville. We're getting ready to break ground here probably within the next month or so on two turfed fields that will have lighting. Also an indoor facility there. So they're needed everywhere. That's a very good location, though, because, you know, it's right off of 79-51. You have a lot of soccer in that area. So, yeah, that's a good location.
Will access to these fields be limited to youth teams, youth clubs?
No. There'll be, you know, there's adult leagues that play out there. The Latino leagues play out there. So, no, it's anybody for anybody that wants field space can just, inquire about renting. So,
What's the sports medicine aspect of the whole project going to include? I know you're not a health professional, but you do have a partnership with the AHN.
Well, we're very fortunate to have a partnership with Allegheny Health, who I feel is they're one of the best in the country, if not, well, they are the best. And to have a partner like that on site is just, it's a game changer, not only for the youth side, for the pro side. If somebody's injured, you know, you're right there, to get the care you need. So this project out there, I feel, is going to be one of the nicest, if not the nicest in the country.
Mm-hmm. Will this also be available to the so-called weekend warriors?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is open to the public. And like I said, anytime anybody's out there, you're going to have full access to medical care if something does happen on these fields.
What's the estimated total cost of the whole project once it's completed all phases?
Once the whole project is done, it'll probably be upwards of about $30
million. Okay. What's your timeline? I mentioned phases, so what's the timeline? What comes first?
Well, the indoor facility is going to come immediately here. That's probably going to go under construction within the next month, and that'll go into next year. Hopefully by the beginning of the third quarter, that'll be open, and then hopefully roll right back into the other 7 fields on the other side.
The indoor field, will it be a full-size field, or will be, you know, the smaller indoor soccer-type field?
No, it'll be full field. It'll be full regulation size.
And how will it be used? How will all the fields be used, the process for all this greater access? How's it going to happen?
Well, there'll be naturally, there'll be an office right there that you just call and make time and make appointments to get on the fields.
Mm-hmm. And the timeline, so the remaining fields, I mean, that seems like a quick turnaround, doesn't it, to have all this done?
Yeah. Yeah, well, we have
I mean,
to.
You're in the construction business. But yeah. It still seems like a quick turnaround.
Yeah, it is. It's the building, the project. Well, we need to get the indoor facility done and get Allegheny Health in there. So that's going to be the top priority right now. And then, like I said, roll right into the fields as long as we can get the funds funds together to get those going.
Okay, we have about a minute left. So with all these changes, additions, whether it's to the stadium, Station Square, the winning atmosphere around the Riverhounds, this new project out in Coraopolis, what are you most excited about as the season continues?
Just seeing the growth and seeing just the vibe from people. I mean, people are so excited. I mean, even on social media today. Last night was just a huge win, and I'm hoping that's a turning point of the season here. We knew this was going to be a tough road trip. You know, three games in 1 week, and we still got another very tough match here Saturday night down in North Carolina to, I believe they're in fifth place now, sort of right below us, but a very tough North Carolina team. You know, hopefully we can get a result there. And so just the excitement of just winning in Pittsburgh and getting people out to build fan base.
Tuffy Schallenberger is the owner of the Pittsburgh Riverhounds. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Kevin.
The Riverhounds are back home at Highmark Stadium next Friday against Loudoun United. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, poet Sarah Valentine grew up in Wexford, a white girl, but later learned her biological father was actually African American. In her new memoir, she grapples with questions about why her family kept that heritage from her for years. A new investigation looks at a legacy of toxic PFAS chemicals at Pittsburgh's airport. And a high school television crew has been nominated for a Student Emmy Award for their work documenting fellow teens at March for Our Lives. Hear from them and so much more when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
You can thank Creedence Clearwater Revival for the success of Woodstock. I mean, it's not all thanks to Creedence, but they were the first major band to sign on to play the legendary music festival that took place 50 years ago today. The promoters had a hard time securing big-name acts, as the modern idea of a music festival didn't really exist in 1969, but once John Fogerty and company committed, everyone else followed suit. In the end, members of CCR weren't exactly thrilled with the festival. They had a 3 a.m. set time, and Fogerty didn't agree to be in the Woodstock movie, but come on, they played Woodstock, and that's all that matters. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
Former firefighters say they routinely used foam containing toxic PFAS chemicals at Pittsburgh's airport, and that's a problem. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Kara Holsapple. In May, we reported that two military bases near Pittsburgh International Airport tested positive for PFAS contamination. PFAS is a class of so-called forever chemicals. They don't degrade and can contaminate water supplies. Now, Oliver Morrison of PublicSource.org has found that the airport itself likely has this chemical contamination, too.
AFFF is the problem. It stands for aqueous film-forming foam. It's a special firefighting foam developed in the late 1960s. It's really good at putting out fuel fires like the ones that can happen during a plane crash. Bob Sharding worked as a firefighter at Pittsburgh International Airport from 1987 to 2007.
Aqueous film-forming foam floats on the surface, so as the fire goes out, it creates a blanket that keeps it from reigniting.
But like many other products, such as Teflon and Scotchgard, AFFF contains PFAS chemicals. If ingested, these chemicals can cause cancers, kidney disease, and hormone disruptions. I talked to five former firefighters at the airport, including Sharding. They say they didn't know these foams were toxic, so instead of cleaning it up, they would let it seep into the ground or wash into streams.
Just about every drop of foam that they ever bought went onto the ground, into the soil, into the waterways of the state.
Sharding says they spilled AFFF when testing the foam equipment. They also used it to cover fuel spills at the airport. In total, he estimates, they spilled thousands of gallons of AFFF.
The FAA totally required it, and to the best of my knowledge, didn't really care how you went about doing it, just as long as they got their numbers.
The Allegheny County Airport Authority released a statement saying it has already switched over to a less toxic form of foam, though they didn't say when. The statement also says the authority is minimizing impacts from its equipment testing. The firefighter said they sometimes use AFFF away from the airport, including at a training facility in North Park. just a little bit of AFFF can cause a big problem. At one fire station in Rhode Island, investigators say a single 5-gallon can of foam contaminated the well water of more than 30 homes. Public Source looked at Pittsburgh airport records, and between 2012 and 2018, the airport purchased nearly 5,000 gallons of foam. In June, I approached Christina Kasotis, Chief Executive Officer for the Allegheny County Airport Authority, after a board meeting.
There's a really high likelihood that there's contamination on the airport. Is the airport going to do anything?
We've done everything that we're required to do, and we'll continue to do everything that we're required.
She's right. There are no laws or regulations that require the airport to do anything about PFAS yet. Congress is looking at legislation. The US EPA is looking into creating new rules, but it could take years. Meanwhile, the public drinking water at the Moon Township Municipal Authority near the airport is already treated to remove PFAS chemicals. But residents with private water wells could be drinking contaminated water. So I asked Kasotis about a National Science Foundation study that recommended airports start looking at how they used AFFF in the past. That way, the airport would know where to look for problems.
Listen, we're doing everything that's required by DEP and the EPA and everything that's required by the FAA. We follow all the rules.
Have you done a historical analysis? Because the National Science Foundation 2017 asked.
All of the rules.
But many airports are going beyond what the rules require. Martha's Vineyard Airport started testing for PFAS last year. It discovered 14 homes had contamination above the EPA's health advisory. Will Pittsburgh's airport eventually follow suit? Right now, they won't say.
That was Oliver Morrison, a reporter at PublicSource.org, which is one of our news partners. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Poet and scholar Sarah Valentine lived the American story of race and racism in a very unusual way. She was raised as white by two white parents. She grew up mostly in Wexford, where because of her skin tone, people sometimes took her as black. At age 27, she confronted her mother about her parentage and learned that her biological father was African American. Now she has written a memoir titled When I Was White. She spoke with 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll.
You were suspicious even when you were younger that there was something you weren't being told about your heritage or your family. That's true, right?
Yeah. When I was growing up, I always realized I was different because people outside of my family would always comment on it. So I knew there was something going on, but I wasn't quite sure, especially because I never got that kind of attention from my family.
Once you knew that you were black, you write about wondering if your own behavior would change. Could you talk about that for a minute?
As someone who grew up as white, I had internalized so many media stereotypes and so much outsider information about what it meant to be black or African American. And I thought, well, if I've lived as a white person, is there something that will automatically change about how I am or how I interact with people? And I, of course, quickly realized that that was not the case. Eventually, I just became a lot more comfortable with being myself in the world, and that includes all of the identities that I encompass.
And you write in the book along those lines about, you know, how this affected your experience with your family, the very family that had lied to you about your ancestry. And you write at one point, why couldn't we, meaning your family, have the same experiences as a family without pretending I was white?
Yeah, that was a question that was very important to me because in so many ways I did have a normal, happy childhood and upbringing, and I always felt loved and accepted by my family. Looking back then, I thought, well, why was it necessary to maintain this silence around the fact that I was African American? What was it about that truth that seemed so unspeakable, or, you know, would it shatter this happy family that we were? And that was really troubling to me.
After you learned about that your father was black, you even as you tried to form sort of a new identity as a black person, you also found yourself having to reckon with the white identity you grew up with. And you talk about how you were realizing you were complicit in whiteness and white oppression then. Can you talk about that aspect?
That was one of the most difficult of the reckoning that you talk about that I had to do with my own identity as all these new revelations came to light was the fact that I had internalized the racism that was both explicit and implicit around me when I was growing up, that I had a lot of anti-Black racism that I directed outward and that informed my worldview and who I was in the world.
Do you think your story has any lessons for, you know, how we talk about race as a society?
One of the big lessons for me was that race and the topic of race shouldn't be taboo. It shouldn't be something that, as difficult as it is and as uncomfortable it may be for white people especially to address because of our country's history with racism. Another lesson I learned in terms of what it meant for me to be African American and having this rather unique experience of being raised white in a white family with all of the white cultural traditions that I had and none of that being African American was that there are as many ways to be Black and as many variations to that identity as there are Black people in the world. I've heard a lot of stories from other people who talk about also feeling not Black enough for some reason, which was an anxiety that I had a lot and still have to some extent. But I've also come to realize that, you know, my identity is as valid as anyone else's. It may just be different.
That was Sarah Valentine talking with 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll. Valentine's memoir is titled When I Was White. She lives in Carson City, Nevada. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It is The Confluence. The fatal shooting at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida in February 2018 sparked a wave of protest and activism from high schoolers across the country. Here in Pittsburgh, a group of students at Shadyside Academy covered the March for Our Lives and other responses to the Parkland shooting for the school's television station, and their reporting was nominated for a Student Emmy Award. Joining us now are Senior George Groom. He's the director, editor, and videographer. Senior L. Santora, who is WSSA-TV's on-air talent, and staff advisor and visual media manager for Shadyside Academy, James Knox. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you
for having us.
First, what were your individual reactions to Parkland, and how did that influence how you wanted to cover this topic? Elle, we're going to start with you.
Thank you. It was a travesty. I think it impacted us in a national level, and it kind of inspired us to act on it, and it inspired us to cover this, because it's become a national issue. It wasn't just Parkland, but it was the spark that caused a huge reaction out of everyone.
Right, George.
I think the fact that it was a school and kids our age, and we saw videos of kids who could have been us, who looked almost identical to us, made it so much more personal. And as a news station, I mean, we didn't have any idea where we wanted to start, but I think that the people around us in our school, like Aaron and Emma, who took forward the lead on March for Our Lives.
They helped organize
the march. Mm-hmm, absolutely. And, I mean, they influenced us a lot to continue and help to get out the message.
Yeah, the news program is usually a little lighthearted mm-hmm. piece that we sort of, you know, poke fun at stuff that's going on at school.
And it's a daily?
It's usually a broadcast about once a month.
Oh, okay.
Usually. There's about four or five of them every year, so it's... Okay. It's hard to pull it all together quickly, mm-hmm. but the fact that it was two students that go to Shadyside that were organizing this huge march for, 10,000 people showed up to, it was sort of the impetus for us to cover it in a more serious way.
Mm-hmm. You've described it as similar to The Daily Show, a lighthearted look at the news. I mean, you had to change gears, change your focus. What was that like, George?
Yeah, getting our first and foremost goal is showing it in front of the whole school. So it's a bunch of teenagers who, a lot of times we focus on making them laugh. So we had to find a way to make sure that they listen. And coming across the school, we have a many different viewpoints. So we made sure that our video it showed the facts mostly. First, showed the facts and made sure that everybody had a voice in the segment. So, that was a difficulty, but I think we did a good job with it.
Now, what was it like to be there in a journalistic capacity covering the actions of your fellow students, your friends, other and colleagues?
Yeah. I mean, it was very impactful. I was always aware of these incidences happening all around us, but I mean, having to cover it and be like in a first person stance and having to actually give my point of view and cover these facts and all these things happening, it was very impactful. I mean, it was a great experience too.
James, as a staff advisor, how do you help? Do you determine or guide the content of that newscast?
I'm sort of there to provide equipment and assistance in technical matters, really. I will put in ideas and stuff, but I kind of have like a veto power over the kids because sometimes they can get a little out of control. And we've had to have some late night edits here and there over stuff that's gone a little far over the top there. But
do you like that creative spirit?
It's fun. Because that was me in high school. You know, I was the kid that was always pushing the boundaries and trying to make, you know, the inappropriate jokes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's segments we do that sort of poke fun at teachers and things. And we did a thing of teacher Jeopardy, sort of like the Saturday Night Live skit. Mm-hmm. And we had the teachers sort of in on the script so that we were going to make great fun of them, but we wanted them to be in on it so it wasn't like a mean, right, like we're, you know, just lampooning these poor people that they don't realize what's happening to them. So
the category your story was nominated in, News General Simon Serious News, it's the most competitive student award category at the Student Emmys. You ultimately did not win, but what was it like to be recognized in that way?
It felt good to be recognized. I definitely think that we were a little disappointed we didn't win. We thought we had a better chance, but I think being nominated was a huge honor.
Yeah, it was very rewarding. I'd have to say it was a great experience for both George and I. We put a lot of work into the whole video recording and taping it, and it felt really great to be recognized for something, because we were really inspired to cover such an influential topic, and so to be acknowledged for that, it was a really great experience.
By the way, people can go and check out that video.
Yes.
It's on Shady Side Academy. Just go Shady Side Academy website, and it's right there.
It's on our YouTube channel,
right?
And there's actually a whole channel of the WSSA TV episodes, and we pulled out the nominated segment, so it's like a standalone, mm-hmm, that you can just view on.
Our guests on The Confluence are George Froom and Els Santora, seniors at Shady Side Academy, and their advisor, James Knox. Their segment on response to the Parkland school shooting was nominated for a student Emmy. I don't believe Shady Side Academy has a communications or journalism program department. Yeah. So does that make the nomination even more impressive?
Yeah, it's sort of like a real shot in the arm, because we don't have a curriculum. I'm not a teacher. I work in the communications department, and so this is sort of an after school project that we do. And so these kids edit, shoot, and brainstorm all these ideas in their free time before they go to soccer practice or tennis practice. I mean George and Elle both play serious sports. I mean, Elle's the most awesome tennis player in the world.
Thank you.
Number one for Shadyside, and El Primo. And then George is the captain of the soccer team. So they're very, very active in other areas. So to find time to squirrel away 5 minutes to talk about doing stuff like this is kind of amazing.
Yeah, you have to want to do it, since it's not part of a class requirement or anything. So you have to take the initiative.
Yeah, the club started about a year and a half ago. I started it with a buddy, and we basically just wanted to share videos that we made. And when Mr. Knox came, he was he wanted to do a news, and I mean, it was a great idea. So we started. I mean, it's definitely It was bootleg at first for a news station, I would call it. But as we got going, I mean, there are so many great ideas in our school. So many kids are creative. So whenever we collaborate and stuff, we can definitely make good stories.
Yeah, we have no budget.
No budget.
Like, most of the equipment is my own personal equipment
built
that we use. Or the teleprompter that we just got this year is super high tech. piece of glass that I got from the art department, and I hot glued styrofoam together, and I put it on an old light stand. So, and put my iPad in there with an app. So, I mean, we're very high tech.
What was the reaction to your fellow students regarding not only the segment? I mean, after they viewed it in assembly, after they viewed this newscast, and then after you were nominated for the Emmy, what was the mood, the atmosphere on campus?
It was quite positive. I mean, we are a small select group of people, but it brought our community together. It made all of us proud of ourselves as a Shadyside unit. And I think as a whole, we were proud of ourselves. We were happy with the work we did and the influence we had on the high school people, alum, teachers, adults, all over the place in the Pittsburgh community.
George, do you think this is a sort of an issue that's lingering on campus? It wasn't just the March for Our Lives and then it was over. Do you think by your doing a story on it and just the impact and the voices that could be expressed by young people, that this will be a lingering issue, a lingering point of conversation on campus?
I absolutely think so. I remember after we showed the segment, I went back to my class, and the first thing I heard two kids talking, they were like, well, what we, because at the very end, we'd have these door locks that were installed by the Shadyside security. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, what do you think about these door locks? And I remember it was a topic of conversation, a small debate that, I mean, lasted. I mean, obviously, that's just a smaller piece of it, but it got kids talking, which, I mean, was really our point, because we weren't there to say this is the right thing to do after gun violence. This, like, we're not calling for gun control. We're not calling for anything else. We were more just saying, let's get the conversation going. I mean, there's a lot of smart kids at our school, and if they start talking, I believe that we can come to a collaborative decision. So
part of it is asking the right questions in the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think one of the pieces of the segment was we recorded a debate between opposing viewpoints on, it was a gun debate that just happened to be occurring on campus, and George and I went and sat in, and it was these two clubs that have, you know, there's a Democratic club and the Patriot Society or whatever they call themselves, and they were having a very casual debate about guns and violence in the wake of all of these things, and so that became a part of it too, as part of the security and the locks and all the things that sort of all kind of came, they came to pass all at the same time and sort of for a perfect story.
I mean, those conversations are far more common at our school. I mean, yeah. Everybody thinks that like the gun debate is so hostile, but I found that they were sat down and were talking about it. It was far more, I mean, there was more common ground than you could think of.
It's a safe environment. I mean, everyone is understanding of each other's opinions. So, I mean, It is, like George said, it's not hostile. It's just a form of conversation. Everyone wants to state their viewpoints, and everyone respects one another, which is, I think, great for us and for progress.
Right. So, very briefly, do you know yet if journalism is something you might want to pursue as a possible career? I know you're both young seniors in high school, George.
I'm not sure yet. I mean, I'm definitely going to have an interest in it for the rest of my life, which I'll be able to listen on news stations with a different light. But I'm not sure if I want to study it.
And Elle?
Probably about the same. I mean, since joining the WSSA news team, I have grown an interest in journalism, but I definitely have to probably think about pursuing it longer. Yeah.
Elle Santora, George Groom, they're seniors at Shadyside Academy. James Knox, WSSA TV faculty and staff advisor, as well as visual media manager at Shadyside Academy. Their work was nominated for a student Emmy. Congratulations. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, it's the Airport Authority's version of Shark Tank. Vendors will pitch their products that they hope will be included in the $1 billion terminal renovation. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered by Tom Hurley, produced by Kylie Kaczynski, with assistance from Julia Zenkovic, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.